Max Jared Murphy is pursuing a nursing career, so it's just Ben Max. But it's all on listener-supported radio station WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It's 8 o'clock, and coming up next, Democracy Now!
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Thank you all very much, and thank you to 40 million Americans, 40 million Californians, and thank you for rejecting this recall.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has soundly defeated a right-wing attempt to remove him from office. We'll go to Sacramento for the latest on the failed recall, then to Afghanistan, where new evidence has emerged showing a recent U.S. drone strike that killed 10 innocent civilians, including 7 children. The Pentagon claimed it was a righteous attack to prevent an ISIS-K bombing. But the New York Times reports the U.S. targeted the car of an aid worker carrying jugs of water.
I lost my brother, my brother's 3 sons, my own daughter, and 4 of my nephews. We cannot even find the bodies at the scene of the strike. We want justice. The American military must hear our voices and never do this again.
Then we speak to a clinical social worker who spent years helping undocumented 9/11 responders and cleanup workers. And we look at why Apple has released an emergency software update for 1.6 billion Apple products after researchers found the Israeli-based mercenary spyware company NSO Group was using a flaw in Apple's code to secretly gain access to devices. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. California Governor Gavin Newsom has handily defeated a recall effort with just over 64% of voters casting no ballots, with two-thirds of votes counted. The failed recall attempt, organized by right-wing opponents of Newsom, cost taxpayers close to $300 million. Newsom's main challenger was anti-immigrant, anti-science conservative talk show host Larry Elder, who said he'd roll back COVID mandates. He also spread false election fraud claims ahead of Tuesday's results. We'll have more on the story from California after headlines. President Biden will call on world leaders to commit to a goal of vaccinating 70% of the global population within a year. The ambitious target, set to be formally announced during an upcoming summit, is very far from current vaccination rates in poorer countries with limited access to vaccines. The World Health Organization is warning most of Africa has been left behind in pandemic recovery efforts, as wealthier countries and drug companies are blocking the fair distribution of vaccines.
More than 5.7 billion doses have been administered globally, but only 2% of those have been administered in Africa. This leaves people at high risk of disease and death, exposed to a deadly virus against which many other people around the world enjoy protection.
A WHO official said this week a vaccine hub established in South Africa may take up to a year to replicate Moderna's vaccine, as talks with the pharmaceutical company on sharing information have stalled. A recent Public Citizen report said the Biden administration has the authority to unilaterally share the recipe for Moderna's vaccine with the world because the U.S. helped fund it. Meanwhile, Britain is the latest country to announce booster shots for people 50 and above and other more vulnerable groups. The UN has called for a halt on third doses amidst the worsening vaccine apartheid between rich and poor countries. Here in New York, 2 judges have temporarily put on hold vaccine mandates for state health workers and New York City teachers. Some health workers argue receiving the vaccine violates their religious beliefs. Poverty rates in the U.S. fell in 2020 thanks to government assistance during the pandemic, including stimulus checks and unemployment aid. The Census Bureau said Tuesday the U.S. supplemental poverty rate fell over 2.5 percentage points to 9.1%, despite the highest unemployment number since the Great Depression. Bernie Sanders, chair of the Senate Budget Committee, tweeted, quote, "When government responds to the needs of the working class, millions of families are lifted out of poverty." Sanders added, quote, "We must not stop here. We must pass the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill and invest in working families," he said. President Biden was in Colorado Tuesday to pitch his infrastructure plans in the wildfire-ravaged, drought-stricken state.
Communities that nearly one in three Americans call home have been struck by weather disasters in just the past few months. Hurricanes in the Gulf Coast are up this eastern seaboard. Wildfires threatening throughout the West and tearing it apart. Droughts and heat waves across the country, devastating farmers and ranchers and draining the Colorado River. In addition to the lost lives shattered, extreme weather cost America last year $99 billion.
Biden's remarks came as a high-risk flood alert was issued in Louisiana as Tropical Depression Nicholas drenches the state with heavy rain and winds, while many communities are still reeling from the destruction of Hurricane Ida. In Haiti, a political crisis is deepening after Prime Minister Ariel Henry fired the country's top public prosecutor hours after the prosecutor said he was seeking charges against Prime Minister Henry over the July assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Prosecutor Bedford Claude said Henri had communicated with a key suspect on the night Moïse was killed. Meanwhile, many Haitians are still struggling to recover from the devastation brought by the 7.2 magnitude earthquake that struck 1 month ago.
As you can observe, we haven't received help from anyone. My house is destroyed. We haven't received help. People who live here are helping us to rebuild this church.
Tensions are ratcheting up on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea fired a submarine-launched ballistic missile earlier today in response to a ballistic missile test by North Korea just hours earlier. It's the first since March and a breach of UN sanctions. 2 days earlier, Pyongyang tested a long-range cruise missile. President Biden previously said he was open to diplomacy with North Korea, but denuclearization talks between the two countries have not resumed since negotiations between Trump and Kim Jong-un broke down in 2019. Back in the United States, the Justice Department charged three former U.S. intelligence and military officials after they admitted to helping the United Arab Emirates build a hacking program. The hackers, who provided the services without an export license, are also accused of stealing personal identifying information and developing a hacking tool that's able to infect a mobile device without the user having to click on anything. The Justice Department has filed an emergency motion urging a federal judge to temporarily block Texas's near-total ban on abortions. The DOJ last week sued Texas over the law, which went into effect September 1st. The legislation bars abortions around 6 weeks into a pregnancy without an exception for rape or incest and allows anyone in Texas to sue patients, medical workers, or even a patient's family or friends who, quote, aid and abet an abortion. Meanwhile, reproductive rights advocates led a protest outside the Maryland home of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, one of five conservative justices who refused to halt the Texas law. A group of Senate Democrats introduced new voting rights legislation Tuesday after reaching a compromise with conservative West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin. The Freedom to Vote Act includes a ban on partisan gerrymandering, universal no-excuse mail-in voting, automatic and election day registration, 2 weeks of early voting, and makes election day a holiday. The bill, however, does away with some of the provisions of the sweeping For the People Act and includes the creation of a voter ID requirement, which voting advocates say disproportionately targets low income and communities of color. But the ID requirement would be far less stringent than those many states are trying to impose. It's unclear whether Democrats can convince 10 Republicans to vote for the bill, prompting renewed calls to abolish the filibuster. And here in New York, more than a dozen elected officials visited Rikers Island this week following repeated reports of the worsening conditions inside the jail complex, including skyrocketing violence, staff shortages, and chronic medical neglect. At least 10 people have died at Rikers so far this year. Following Monday's visit, New York Assemblymember Emily Gallagher tweeted, quote, "What I witnessed was a humanitarian crisis, a horror house of abuse and neglect." And this is New York Assembly member Jessica Gonzalez Rojas speaking Monday after touring Rikers.
People have been stuck inside for days, for weeks, for months without a court hearing, without being able to get transported to court, without medical care. I just witnessed an attempted suicide. Yes, come here. Jumped up there and tried to hang himself. Senator Ramos was right there. Nobody deserves this. These are human beings.
The new New York Governor Kathy Hochul also visited Rikers this week. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, Californians overwhelmingly rejected a Republican-led recall effort against Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom Tuesday. The failed recall attempt cost close to $300 million in taxpayer dollars and was seen as a battle against the far right. Speaking from the California Democratic headquarters in Sacramento, Newsom thanked voters and criticized former President Trump's claim the recall was rigged.
I want to focus on what we said yes to as a state. We said yes to science. We said yes to vaccines. We said yes to ending this pandemic. We said yes to people's right to vote without fear of fake fraud or voter suppression. We said yes to women's fundamental constitutional right to decide for herself what she does with her body and her fate and future. We said yes to diversity. We said yes to inclusion. We said yes to pluralism. You know, we may have defeated Trump, but Trumpism is not dead in this country. The big lie, the January 6th insurrection, all the voting suppression efforts that are happening all across this country, what's happening, the assault on fundamental rights, constitutionally protected rights of women and girls. It's a remarkable moment in our nation's history.
The attempt to recall Governor Newsom was seen as a referendum on several key issues, and Democrats at the national level closely watched the race ahead of the 2022 midterms. Early exit polls show Latinos make up to 25% of the electorate, responding in part to the anti-immigrant views of Newsom's leading Republican challenger, right-wing radio host Larry Elder. Elder conceded Tuesday night, but vowed to run again, saying, quote, we may have lost the battle, but we're going to win the war. Governor Newsom faces re-election next year. For more, we go to Sacramento, the capital of California. We're joined by Sasha Abramski, Left Coast correspondent for The Nation, who's been closely following this recall attempt. Welcome back to Democracy Now! So the final vote isn't in, Sasha, but it looks like a 2-1 trouncing, not something the Democrats thought along the way. Can you talk about what decided this and elevating this to a national level and taking on Elder as a surrogate for Trump, essentially?
Yeah, good morning. You're right. I think most people didn't predict this, and I certainly didn't. I was following the polls for the last 3 months, and I was writing about what could happen. And for the last 3 months, there were these sort of two different lines going on in the polls. So one line was all voters in California. And right from the get-go, Newsom was ahead on that one, because this is a very, very blue state. And broadly speaking, Newsom's policies on climate change, on COVID vaccines, on abortion and so on, gel with the majority of Californians' ideas about what kind of society they want to live on. But the second line was likely voters. And in July and August, you saw this sort of massive contraction of Newsom's lead. And in a lot of polls, especially about 6 weeks ago, Newsom was actually trailing. He wasn't crossing that 50% threshold to survive the recall. I think what happened over the last month or so was Californians began paying attention. And California makes it easy to vote. You don't have to jump through hoops like you do in Texas or Georgia or many of these other states that have imposed these restrictions. In California, you get mailed a ballot. In other words, the state makes it easy for you to vote. And what happened was, as the ballots came into people's mailboxes, as attention started being focused nationally on this election, people started realizing what was at stake. That didn't mean that as many people were going to vote as voted in the presidential election, but instead of it being a sort of catastrophically low voter turnout, more and more people said, all right, I'm a likely voter here. This is easy. All I have to do is mail in a ballot. And the issues are important. And Larry Elder was a brilliant foil for Newsom because Elder's policies, they're to the right of Greg Abbott's policies in Texas. I mean, this guy is so far right wing. And there was this real risk that California could sort of almost accidentally stumble into a far right governorship. And I think Newsom played it very well, that he sort of used Elder relentlessly as his foil, and he managed to focus and coalesce his coalition's attention on that issue.
And Sasha, I wanted to ask you two things. First of all, it looking back at it, this could have been the best thing that could have happened politically to Newsom, especially in light of the fact that there is a governor's race in California next year. So that means that not only has he established closer to that election the popular support he has, but also the reports are that he's got $24 million additional left over from his fundraising for this campaign for that mayor's race. I wanted to ask you about that. And then also about a lot of the pundits were wrong, claiming that Latino voters in California weren't that interested. And yet we find a significant increase in the percentage of the vote that was from the Latino community in this this recall election.
Yeah, I think both of those are important points. Newsom's a formidable fundraiser. He has other problems and other political baggage, but fundraising has never been one of Newsom's problems. He's keyed into all of the top fundraising mechanisms in the state and in the country, and he used it to ruthless effect in this election. So you're right, he goes into 2024 or 2022 with a huge war chest. The other thing about that is when Newsom was riding high at the start of the pandemic, back in the spring of 2020, when he shut the state down early, he stopped a sort of initial surge. People talked about him as a viable presidential candidate. And then the pandemic dragged on and his responses seemed to sort of be less successful and the opposition to the lockdowns grew more vocal. And the sort of conventional wisdom was that Newsom's moment in the spotlight had gone, that he had sort of messed up enough that he was no longer a top-tier candidate. I think what yesterday's election shows is somebody with that kind of fundraising potential and somebody who is that able to knock down and sort of almost swat away Trumpism and the Trumpist claims about a rigged election and so on, you have to consider him as a potential presidential candidate, you know, maybe in 2024, but far more likely in 2028. So I think that's number one. Your other issue about the Latino vote, you're absolutely right again on this, that for the last many, many weeks, there was a series of articles coming out saying that Latinos were disengaged. And the New York Times had a huge piece saying that they either weren't voting in large numbers or were tilting sort of more rightward than would be expected. And in actual fact, that didn't happen. In actual fact, if you look at the coalition that supported Newsom yesterday, that coalition is fairly much the same as the coalition that put him into power with a 24-point win in 2018. Newsom's going to win by either 24 or 25 or maybe even 26%. It is a lower voter turnout, but it's not a catastrophically lower voter turnout. And I think that's really important to note, that all of the moving parts of the complex Democratic coalition in California came out to vote yesterday.
And if you can talk about the issues that Democrats and the Latinx population and overall progressives in California have been critical of Newsom for, and how he may change course in this year, for example, around relationships with ICE, as well as the unhoused, particularly made difficult during this time of massive fires through California.
Yeah, I mean, Newsom has in many ways run to the left as a governor. He's talked the talk on the environment, though he hasn't always walked the walk. He's certainly doing big and bold things on housing. He's put $12 billion into tackling housing and the unhoused. And that's a huge issue because this state has 160,000 plus homeless people. Here in Sacramento, which is not a big city, it's about 500,000 people. On any given night, there are 5,000 people sleeping on the streets. So 1 in 100 residents in Sacramento is sleeping on the streets. This is extraordinary. Newsom's put in an absolutely vast amount of money in the last year in particular into trying to solve those issues. So you asked what are the issues that are sort of getting Democrats angry about Newsom's governorship and what are the issues that he can now sort of run on and move on. Environment is up there. Wildfires are up there. California's had this series of catastrophic wildfires for 6 years in a row now. housing is up there, but also things like access to healthcare. I mean, this is a very expensive state in many, many ways. But one way that Newsom is making it less expensive is he's putting in place through signing a series of laws that make healthcare more affordable, not just for the uninsured, but for the people using the California Health Exchange. So you're getting put in place on healthcare, on housing, on various other social programs, the beginning of something that looks like a social democracy in California, that you're seeing a series of policies being created and being pushed that more resemble maybe a Scandinavian social democracy than Texas or Mississippi or Georgia. And that's obviously a low bar because nobody wants to look like Texas or Mississippi or Georgia if they have progressive credentials. But what I mean by that is California is charting its own course, and it's doing so in a way that could have major ramifications nationally because, you know, it's an old canard where California goes, the rest of the country follows. Well, not always, but California is putting in place a template that's going to produce a more comprehensive, not quite cradle to the grave, but a much more comprehensive social safety net. And if it works, it's going to produce an extraordinary momentum nationally to enact some of these measures.
We want to thank you, Sasha Abramsky, for joining us, the so-called Left Coast correspondent for The Nation. Next up, we're going to Afghanistan, where new evidence has emerged showing a recent U.S. drone strike killed 10 innocent civilians, including 7 children. The Pentagon has claimed it was a, quote, righteous attack. Stay with us. Leave to Remain by Sarathi Korwar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Afghanistan. It's been 1 month since the Taliban seized control of Kabul after Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled the country. On Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken defended the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan during a second day of questioning on Capitol Hill. Blinken was grilled about a U.S. drone strike in Kabul on August 29th. It's the last drone strike before the withdrawal. The Pentagon claimed the strike targeted a facilitator with the militant group ISIS-K who was preparing to attack the Kabul airport. But local residents said the strike killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, and Zamari Ahmadi, not an ISIS-K operative, but an Afghan engineer who had worked since 2006 for the California-based charity group Nutrition and Education International. The Pentagon claims surveillance videos showed Zamari loading what they thought were explosives into a car at an unknown compound earlier in the day. But video evidence obtained by the New York Times found Zamari was actually loading canisters of water at the charity's office to deliver to those in need. The Pentagon's described the drone attack as a righteous strike. But on Tuesday, Secretary of State Blinken acknowledged the U.S. is not certain who was targeted when questioned by Republican Senator Rand Paul.
The guy the Biden administration droned, was he an aid worker or an ISIS-K operative?
The administration is, of course, reviewing that strike. And I'm sure that a full assessment will be forthcoming.
So you don't know if it was an aid worker or an ISIS-K operative?
I can't speak to that, and I can't speak to that in this setting in any event.
So you don't know or won't tell us?
I don't know because we're reviewing it.
Well, see, you'd think you'd kind of know before you off somebody with a Predator drone whether he's an aid worker or he's an ISIS-K. See, the thing is this isn't just you. It's been going on for administration after administration.
We go now to Kabul, Afghanistan, where we're joined by Matthew Akins of the New York Times. You wrote the recent piece headlined, "In U.S. Drone Strike, Evidence Suggests No ISIS Bomb." Matthew, talk about going to the site, to the family's home where the car was, and describe what you learned happened that day, August 29th.
Well, August 29th, there was the strike in the evening, and we went the next morning, myself and a photographer for the Times, Jim Hoylebrook, and we arrived at the scene. It was inside a courtyard of a house where a car had been hit, and there was a small crater, still flesh and blood spattered around the interior of the courtyard, and we spoke to the family who lived there, and they were extremely distraught because they had just lost 10 members of their family, including 7 children. So it was immediately apparent that there had been civilian casualties in the strike. And then, you know, when we followed up with our investigation over the past 2 weeks, we put together evidence that showed that this, what the military interpreted as a series of suspicious moves from the sky, was, according to his coworkers and colleagues and video evidence, just an ordinary day for this aid worker.
And Matthew, the continued stonewalling, effectively, of the government in terms of what they have found out since is really remarkable. I'm just wondering, basic stuff like how many people died, there's a big difference between 10 and the official count that the U.S. is still saying of 3 civilians. They haven't quite explained why they claimed Mr. Ahmadi was driving into an unknown compound at one point, which actually was the aid agency's headquarters in Kabul. They're not even making clear whether they've checked if he was an employee of this U.S.-based aid group. What do you make of this continued almost refusal to explain the results of what they've investigated so far?
Well, certainly they have a lot to answer for, a lot to explain, but they are conducting an investigation, and typically when the military does a sort of investigation, you do have to wait for the results. They're going to be classified, but they'll probably brief them to lawmakers and then eventually release a redacted version of the investigation. So at this point, I don't think we're going to hear anything, at least not officially, until that's completed.
On September 1st, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, described the drone attack as a righteous strike.
We know that there were secondary explosions. Because there were secondary explosions, there's a reasonable conclusion to be made that there was explosives in that vehicle. The third thing is we know from a variety of other means that at least one of those people that were killed was a ISIS facilitator. So were there others killed? Yes, there are others killed. Who they are, we don't know. We'll try to sort through all that. But we believe that the procedures at this point, I don't want to influence the outcome of an investigation, but at this point we think that the procedures were correctly followed and it was a righteous strike.
So that's General Mark Milley. Evidence examined by the New York Times at the scene of the drone strike suggests there was not a second explosion.
We gathered photos and videos of the scene taken by journalists and visited the courtyard multiple times. We shared the evidence with 3 weapons experts who said the damage was consistent with the impact of a Hellfire missile. They pointed to the small crater beneath Ahmadi's car and the damage from the metal fragments of the warhead. This plastic melted as a result of a car fire triggered by the missile strike. All 3 experts also pointed out what was missing: any evidence of the large secondary explosions described by the Pentagon. No collapsed or blown out walls, including next to the trunk with the alleged explosives. No sign that a second car parked in the courtyard was overturned by a large blast. No destroyed vegetation. All of this matches what eyewitnesses told us, that a single missile exploded and triggered a large fire.
So that's the New York Times video report based on Matthew Akins' investigation of the U.S. drone strike. So if you could elaborate that on that, Matthew, and also talk about why the children, why there were 7 children in Zamari's car.
Sure. Well, the investigation was definitely a team effort, and we had experts look at the photos and videos that we were able to collect from the scene. And that was really the military's justification, from what we've learned at least thus far, for taking the strike. You know, that this was an imminent threat to the airport because they took the shot inside a crowded residential neighborhood where there was a very high likelihood of civilian casualties. You know, that's a kind of assumption that I think would have been fair in that circumstance. So really the way they would have justified this was that this was a car bomb or some kind of imminent threat. And I think it's pretty conclusive that there was not a larger explosive in this car. Now, what happened was is that Zemirai's family, you know, the kids, he lived with his three brothers, so there's a lot of kids in his house. And when he came home every day from work, I was told by his brother, he'd pull up and the kids would run out and they'd be excited to see him. And they'd get in the car and, you know, usually one of them would sit behind the wheel, maybe on his lap, and they would back the car in the courtyard. So that's what they said happened that day. So those kids were in the car when it was struck by a Hellfire missile. And that is the reason why seven of them were killed.
And Matthew, what is this, from your reporting in Afghanistan, what does this tell us about the limitations of these drone strikes, the inherent problems that exist when you rely essentially on aerial surveillance to determine who you strike or not versus on the ground real human intelligence?
Yeah, so this is not an isolated incident. You know, we've had civilian casualties from drone strikes many times over the years. But the fact of the matter was, this happened in Kabul. You know, I was able to go to the scene, and we were able to do the story in 2 weeks. Normally, these happen in remote, dangerous areas, difficult to access. So often all we have is the military's official version of the events. In this case, this guy was an ISIS facilitator, and that there was explosives in the car. So the danger with these strikes, which, again, this may have been the last drone strike of the 20-year American war, but the war on terror continues, and there's going to be more drone strikes, you know, that's promised by the administration over the horizon role in places like Afghanistan. The danger is that we're going to have more of these incidents. There's going to be more children killed, but that we're not going to really even know about it because, again, we're not going to have access to what's happening on the ground.
And, of course, these drone strikes lessen the chance of U.S. soldiers being killed as they fly over from another country, as you said, the over-the-horizon capability they're talking about. But I wanted to go to one last video that you obtained, security camera footage from the office of the U.S.-based aid group Nutrition and Education International, where Zamiri Ahmadi had worked earlier in the day.
At 2:35 p.m., Ahmadi pulls out a hose, and then he and a co-worker fill empty containers with water. Earlier that morning, we saw Ahmadi bring these same empty plastic containers to the office. There was a water shortage in his neighborhood, his family said, so he regularly brought water home from the office.
So we're looking at this closed-circuit footage of him gathering this water to bring home. The U.S. apparently was monitoring him for hours that day, Matthew.
Yeah, they said that they were surveilling him with an MQ-9 Reaper drone. But again, you know, what they see from the sky and what's happening on the ground are not necessarily the same thing. And in this case, you know, this was a man who had loaded water in the car to bring home to his family.
Well, Matthew, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Matthew Akins, Kabul-based contributing writer to the New York Times and New York Times Magazine. His investigation into the drone strike headlined, "In U.S. Drone Strike, Evidence Suggests No ISIS Bomb." Next up, we go to a clinical social worker helping undocumented 9/11 responders and cleanup workers 20 years later, even to this day. Stay with us.
buscando que es ilegal, que en realidad no lo eran, aliados los federales. Un día una gran redada en un barrio de latinos, ya con toda su tropa, llegaron echando gritos para...
The Ballad of David and Goliath by Flor de Telohuache, an all-woman mariachi band from the Bronx. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Yes, this past weekend marked the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks that killed 3,000 people September 11, 2001, including hundreds of immigrants who worked low-wage jobs, cleaning and restaurant jobs in the World Trade Center towers. As many as 6,000 undocumented immigrants later took part in the recovery and cleanup efforts. Today, we're continuing our coverage of the impact of 9/11 as we look at those who went uncounted in death as they go uncounted in life because they were undocumented and others feared deportation, didn't seek medical help. This is Maria Penafiel, an immigrant from Colombia who helped in the cleanup efforts after the 9/11 attacks, speaking in the new documentary 9/11's Unsettled Dust.
I was working at Stuyvesant High School. They don't give the hazmat to wearing for cleaning. Most of the people are cleaning around and cleaning in the building around the World Trade Center and undocumented. When you speak about the trauma, for me it's muy terrible because the day doesn't finish.
You can see our full show on 9/11's Unsettled Dust at democracynow.org that also features the investigative work of our very own Juan Gonzalez, who should have won a Pulitzer Prize for the investigation of what happened to so many as a result of the carcinogenic and deadly substances in the aftermath of the attacks that people inhaled. Well, now some of the immigrant 9/11 responders and cleanup workers are calling for lawmakers to establish a pathway for legal residency. That could cover as many as 2,000 immigrants. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said she's actively exploring the possibility of reintroducing a bill to do this, a bill that the man she beat for Congress, Joe Crowley, had introduced. For more, we're joined by Rosa Bramble Caballero, a licensed clinical social worker who's helped immigrant 9/11 workers for 15 years and hosts meetings in the basement of her office in Queens. Rosa, thank you so much for being with us. What should we understand? This whole idea that those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death. Maybe we don't even know the exact number of people who died at the World Trade Center.
Yes, good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me. Actually, with the undocumented workers who worked at Ground Zero in the recovery efforts, many actually have died or have returned to their countries. And there's really no record because no one is really keeping record of these workers who really sacrificed their lives because as many people, many of us, right, were in our homes and in our safety, they were out there cleaning up, exposing themselves to so many toxins, and they had a spirit of recovery. They wanted to be part of the efforts. And now, 20 years later, they're pretty much left in the dark. Like one of our the workers said, estamos olvidados. Nos dejaron olvidados. We have been forgotten. And because after 20 years, many of them cannot work, and at least a status to citizenship would really not only acknowledge their work, but would also help them have other options of other types of work. Some of them have returned to their countries and have come back through the borders in order to be able to get medical monitoring, but they're undocumented. And they were present in such a devastating day. And we have not really honored them as we should.
And Rosa Maria, there were actually two categories of undocumented workers. There were those who were in the towers when the attack happened. There were many who worked, for instance, in the restaurants at Windows on the World, at the top of One World Trade Center. There were some that worked in maintenance of the buildings as well, who were directly affected that day. But then, as you mentioned also, there were people that were brought in because every single building in Lower Manhattan had to be decontaminated or cleaned up after the attacks. Right. From the contaminants, and the city of New York basically left it up to each individual landlord to do its own cleanup. Not any kind of checking or safety precautions were instituted. So what has happened to these both of these categories in terms of the compensation funds that have been set up? Are they eligible for them, or what has happened as far as you know from the people you've talked to?
Yeah, so I haven't worked directly with the survivors, if you will, workers who were actually workers of the World Trade Center, say the Windows of the World and so forth, or maintenance. My work has been primarily with those who worked in the recovery and cleanup efforts. And some of them have received compensation under the Sodroga law. But prior to that, there were, as you were saying, when like these were different buildings and they were trying to get compensation, initially a lot of that money, since they had to go to a private attorneys took a 33% of whatever little they were getting. And so they were pretty much left with really minimal income. And the group that was working as cleanup workers under the James Sodroga Act, some of them have received funds. Some of them are still waiting. And if you think about compensation, there's one worker that I'm thinking about in which after working there for so many months, and by the way, the undocumented workers were the last group of people who worked in the zone, in Ground Zero. The recovery efforts ended in June 2002, and a lot of them remained there until June. So we're talking about over 6 months of work. And this one particular worker, he received $52,000, and he basically cannot work anymore. First, he's undocumented, but certainly the GERD, the asthma, all the respiratory challenges that he has developed as a result, the compensation was $52,000, which he no longer has. He has a family to support. So it's not really, really, it doesn't really, how should I say it, really compensate for the efforts that a lot of them made. Some of them have not received the funds. They're still waiting. In fact, I spoke to a worker a couple of days ago who was affected by Hurricane Ida in Queens. A lot of our workers work in Jackson Heights and areas where, for example, Joseph Crowley and now Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is now, you know, the Congress representative. A lot of them have been affected. And she was telling me that after all of these years, she still has not received anything from the compensation fund. So
Rosa,
not really enough effort anymore. We're not getting an effort. We don't hear anything. So what I do is I still have people coming in after all these years who have been fearful because of their immigration status to come forth and receive medical monitoring, to come forth and apply for a compensation that they rightly deserve and ought to receive.
Rosa, if you could talk about also the push for these cleanup workers to get a path to citizenship, and also if you can talk about the children of the dead undocumented immigrant cleanup workers.
Yeah, you know, the bill, the 9/11 Immigration Worker Freedom Act was introduced in 2017. and it was based on one of the workers who was detained by ICE, and we had a few Congress representatives who came forth and the governor to pardon him. And so the bill was introduced. The bill really is a pathway to begin citizenship, that those who worked in the area, who were driving vehicles, have the right to readjust their status. And that's really what we're talking about. Because without that, these workers do not really have a life, and neither do their children. We have workers who have died. And I'm thinking of Rafael Hernandez, who was a volunteer firefighter. And he rescued one of people on that day. He died in 2010. And right before, you know, we would meet, and we had empanadas, and he was telling me how ill he was feeling. And he died because of 9/11 related illnesses. His son, who is now in Mexico, is in college. He can't even go to college, in fact. There is no funding. There is nothing available for the children of undocumented workers who died because they sacrificed their lives in this recovery effort. I've reached out to different organizations that I'm not going to name, and because the parent was undocumented, these children are not getting the support and help that they need. I have one family who had to move out of the state because the parent, he was so ill, and he's alive, thank God, but he can't really work anymore, and his children are struggling. He calls me, says, where can I get help? You know, we try at least through the standing organizations that ought to be helping the children of the 9/11 recovery workers, and no one is. And we believe, that with this bill, it would allow for these workers to not only help themselves, but certainly help their families, because as immigrants, they're here sacrificing their lives for their children, for their children to get an education and move ahead.
And Rosa, just quickly, could you tell us how did you get involved? You're a clinical social worker. You've been doing a lot of this out of your home. What prompted you to get involved in these efforts?
Right, Juan. So it's not out of my home. It's out of my office. In 2006, a couple of colleagues and I were contracted, actually, by a subcontractor of the city to do outreach to Latinx immigrants who work at Ground Zero, because many people were not coming forth. And so we did that. These funds ended. All the funds ended. Mental health, round table to help these folks. Everything ended in 2010, precisely on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Okay. And early in that year, a couple of previous clients called me and said, you know, there's nothing available now. We would like to meet. There's no place for us to meet now. There's no organizations helping us. Can you help us? Because at that point, some of the compensation laws were starting to come forth, and you know, navigating and just coming together to support each other. Many of them do not have families here, so really creating community. And Juan, as an immigrant myself, I'm from Venezuela, I think of my mother probably would have worked at Ground Zero if she would have had to. So it's really the commitment to my community that I felt that this is something I needed to do. And so I've been doing this as a volunteer for really all these years.
Rosa Rosa, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Rosa Bramble Caballero, bilingual, licensed clinical social worker who's helped 9/11 clean up immigrant workers for 15 years, those cleanup workers in so much need. And to see more of her story and what she's done, you can see this amazing film that's aired on PBS called 9/11's Unsettled Dust, and our extended discussion on this last week at democracynow.org. Well, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Apple has released an emergency software update to fix a security flaw in its iPhones and other products researchers found was being exploited by the Israeli-based NSO group to infect the devices with its Pegasus spyware. Over 1.65 billion Apple products in use around the globe were vulnerable to the spyware since at least March. Apple said vulnerable devices could be hacked by receiving a malicious PDF file that users don't even have to click, known as zero-click exploit. The flaw was discovered by the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab, which found the hack in the iPhone records of a Saudi political activist. Earlier this year, a massive data leak revealed Pegasus software had targeted the phones of thousands of journalists, activists, and political figures around the world for foreign governments and NSO group clients. We're ending today's show with Ronald Deibert. He is the director of the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. He's also author of the recent book, Reset, Reclaiming the Internet for Civil Society. Ron Deibert, thanks so much for joining us at this early hour as you speak to us from Vancouver. Can you talk about the significance of this flaw, how it was discovered, and what it's doing to so many billions of, or to 1.6 billion Apple products?
Sure. Thank you for having me, Amy. We examined the phone of a Saudi activist who is part of a research study that we are running in March 2021 and determined that their iPhone had been hacked with NSO Group's Pegasus spyware. NSO Group is a mercenary surveillance company based in Israel that has been the subject of numerous prior Citizen Lab reports. We have shown that their technology, which is marketed to governments to assist in law enforcement and national security investigations, is in fact widely abused. It's used to target broad sections of civil society, including journalists, human rights defenders, lawyers, and others. This was yet another case of an abuse of this type of spyware. This particular exploit that we discovered on the Saudi activist's phone was extremely sophisticated. It is what's known as a zero-click, zero-day. And by that, I mean that the surveillance technology could be implanted on a target's device without any visible interaction on the part of the user, no evidence that this is happening. It exploits a flaw in Apple's iMessage application that even at the time Apple did not know about. So this means that any government client using NSO Group spyware could silently take over any Apple device in the world. And as you say, there are 1.65 billion Apple users around the world. And this affected all Apple iOS, macOS, watchOS devices. Notified Apple of the discovery, and they moved very quickly within 6 days to push out this emergency software update, which takes care of the problem. But we estimate that this has been active since about February 2021. So what this case illustrates is, again, this widespread abuse that we have associated with NSO Group and other companies like it, their technology.
And Ronald Deibert, could you talk about a little bit more about NSO Group's track record in other issues of cyber espionage?
Sure. So we and others, our partners at Amnesty International, other research groups, have been tracking, broadly speaking, the commercial spyware market for many years now. And NSO Group first came on our radar, you will recall, back in 2016 when we discovered it was being used by the United Arab Emirates to target a human rights defender named Ahmad Mansour. Ever since then, we and others have documented extensive abuses of this company's technology. So not surprisingly, when you have no regulation over a marketplace like this, and a company really is doing no due diligence, they're just simply in it for the profit, you will have extensive abuse because they're selling to government clients that lack oversight over their security agencies, that lack transparency, public accountability. Most of them are kleptocrats or dictators, countries like Saudi Arabia, which we know has a terrible human rights track record. They will take this technology and go after their adversaries, whoever they may be. That could include you or Amy, in fact. We have seen extensive targeting of journalists using NSO's technology. Really, it's not surprising that we are able to do this, although we have an extremely talented technical team at the Citizen Lab that does this investigation. When this type of technology is sold to government clients and is abused in this way, obviously watchdog organizations like this are likely going to spot it. So this underlines the urgency of this unregulated marketplace. I think now it's become more than obvious that there are extensive damages associated with this industry that need to be cleaned up very quickly. And the only way to do that, frankly, is by some kind of international regulation.
And you mentioned UAE. We had a headline today about the Justice Department charging three former U.S. intelligence and military officials after they admitted to helping the United Arab Emirates build a hacking program. Talk about the dissidents that are targeted in this and how this fits into this other story.
Well, the individuals that you mentioned who are former NSA engineers working for this startup in the UAE actually targeted us at the Citizen Lab, we discovered, as part of the whistleblower leak associated with that. So basically what's happening here is, you know, all of us carry with us 24 hours a day these devices in our pockets. They're engineered very well for the most part, but they contain various software flaws. Inevitably, that's the nature of the ecosystem that we live in. And governments have a very large appetite to hack into those devices because they're so rich with details about anyone's lives. Now, this means that governments that, you know, don't follow the rule of law or respect human rights, if they have these in their arsenal, they're going to go after anyone they consider to be a regime critic. And that's what's happening right now. So that means journalists, lawyers, activists, people who have fled their countries out of fear of the regime, managed to move safely to a country like Canada, they are not immune from this new type of transnational repression. So what companies like NSO Group are offering up really is a kind of despotism as a service.
And I want to ask you, we have less than a minute left, but what does it say about the world that we're living in today, that we need groups like your Citizen Lab and the independent actions of some companies like Apple to actually try to rein in what is occurring rather than the actual governments and agencies that are supposed to protect the public?
Well, that's an excellent question, Juan, and unfortunately it's a bit of a dark answer. As you know, the world is sliding into despotism and authoritarianism, even within liberal democratic countries, and we need to look no further than within the United States and the troubling events of recent times. All governments are interested in this technology. Some of them may have legitimate needs for this type of thing because they're doing their investigations. But as we know, there's so much corruption around the world, so many governments that lack public accountability and transparency, so many intelligence agencies that are doing horrible things, largely out of control. This simply fuels that fire. This is, in my opinion, the most important crisis around global civil society right now. We can't solve all the other problems if people are being spied on willy-nilly like this.
We want to thank you so much, Ronald Deibert, Director of the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto and author of Reset, Reclaiming the Internet for Civil Society. We're going to do part two of the conversation, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. How do you protect yourself? And a very happy birthday to Sam Alkoff. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in. Democracy Now, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m.